Monster Man, episode 212, Hibsil. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're doing just one monster from the 8th chapter of Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And that is because there is only one more monster left in the 8th chapter, and I don't want to split up the J chapter because it works out to episodes quite nicely. Today we're just going to talk about the Hibsil. But before we do that, I thought I would take this opportunity to take a look at some listener mail. And this is one that's long overdue for an answer. Way back when I did my listener request special on Uz, the Trolls of Glorantha, I got a message from James Bailey. Excuse me, that's two-time Monster Man contest winner James Bailey. And James was talking about Uz and sort of some of the ways that they don't really work in D&D. He said, "The idea of a high tension or very different culture is quite close in some ways to how I'm developing goblins. In the setting I'm working on, goblins have a bunch of these sorts of fundamental differences to the human or human-adjacent species, right down to reproduction. They're essentially summoned spirits who at some point in the long-forgotten past worked out how to summon more of themselves. They have a completely different social system, so every village has to have some kind of alchemist to avoid it dying out. I've only run two one-shots in this setting so far, but I'm getting similar interest from the bafflement of goblins and humanoids at one another. I wonder if the issue with having monsters in that niche in D&D proper is exacerbated by the alignment system. I mean, what is an Uz on the alignment chart? True neutral? Whilst alignment charts are sort of surface-level fun in their way, I feel like they maybe pigeonhole monsters into what people start thinking of as teams rather than just vague outlooks, and you need to break out of that mode of thought to get some of these more complex culture options set up." I think that could be true. I have never had the objections to D&D's alignment system that people seem to. I feel like lawful and chaotic maybe is like a bad name, and if you changed it to good versus evil and freedom versus order, then I think that that would, you know, we think chaos is bad. I think if you replaced chaotic with, I mean, I don't know what the term would be, but if you said, you know, they're not in favor of chaos, they're in favor of freedom. And these guys aren't so much in favor of law, because law immediately, like, brings up the point that a lot of D&D characters are basically just criminals, right? But if you think, well, no, you know, if you're the kind of person that thinks there have to be rules, there's a summary of this in the TV show Sons of Anarchy, which I watched a lot of, but I'm not a huge fan of. Anyway, one of the characters explains that even though he disagrees with the rule of the club, he's going to follow it because you can't just have people making up their own rules. Everyone is not supposed to decide which rules they intend to follow and which rules they don't. And that's particularly true because this club is full of bad people. Right, that you don't want them deciding what the rules are because they're a bunch of self-interested dirtbags. I mean, I don't think he says that, but I think that's very much implied. I think that you can take a look at Uz culture and go, no, it's lawful, right? It's got this extremely rigid hierarchical structure that definitely makes it lawful in its orientation, and that's opposed to, like, if you think about in Glorantha the difference between lunar and Orlanthi culture, you would say that the lunar culture is lawful, while the Orlanthi culture is chaotic. Orlanthi culture is actually highly organized, it has a complex system of laws, but Orlanthi believe in personal freedom as an important principle. One of the core beliefs that the Orlanthi have is, no one can make you do anything. And even the more reasoned and mature Ernalda view of the world, or at least that's how I view it, has as one of its fundamental principles, there is always another way. So anyway, I think the alignment system, if viewed in the correct way, which may mean sort of squinting at it, which is kind of what I do, I think is compatible with complex monster cultures as long as you're not beginning and ending your analysis with the alignment system, going, well, these guys are lawful evil and those guys are chaotic evil and therefore they have these exact qualities. I think that I discuss that a lot in terms of demons and devils because their lawful evil and chaotic evilness is the most important thing about them. It's their defining feature. But otherwise, I think I tend to see the alignments as questions of what your character prizes. In the same way that if you think about the way that the belief system in Unknown Armies works, It's what your character's, the stimuli, it's what your character's principles are, right? So your noble stimulus is a thing you believe, a thing you aspire to, rather than a thing that you necessarily are. So even good aligned people do harm, but they believe that, but they believe in the good principle of valuing the freedom and safety of all sentient beings, even if they don't always necessarily carry it out. I do like those goblins, though. I like my goblins weird. They sound a bit sci-fi for the kind of fairy tale goblins that I like, but a definite sense of weirdness, which I think is really important. So thank you very much for writing in, James. I always like hearing from you, and I'm sorry that it sometimes takes so long to get back. Let's talk about the Hypsil. So the Hypsil are weird little dudes. They're kind of centaurs, but rather than horse bodies, they have antelope bodies. So that definitely gives them a sense of kind of slenderness and fast movement and agility. In other respects, they're kind of, you know, they're hassle monsters. They shoot bows that have arrows that put you to sleep. Their tough constitutions make them very resilient to poison. There's not all that much else about them. They do have a great illustration in which the Hypsil has a kind of like a human-like but not completely human face that's got a suspicious expression, I would say, on it. So you can definitely see that these are people who are sort of wary and maybe not absolutely welcoming to outsiders, but don't have the kind of wildness and aggression that you think of when you think of centaurs, or at least you do if you think about them in classical terms. So one of the things that I was thinking about as I was reading about the Hypsil is that they're very 70s-y, and I don't know that I could explain what that is, other than that, if you look at sort of fantasy art from the 70s, and I guess from the 80s, you're going to see these kinds of creatures. And what they do, I think, is they're an attempt to have both familiarity and alienness. So centaurs as an image are familiar to us. And centaurs are familiar to us in a way because horses are. You know, obviously there's no such thing as centaurs, but we all know what centaurs are like because they appear in art. And centaurs are like what they're like because they combine the traits of a human and the traits of a horse. This idea of a wild horse, right? This powerful creature that's fast moving and maybe not able to be restrained. So similarly with the Hypsil, there's that sense of familiarity when you think of a centaur, and there's that sense of familiarity when you think of an antelope. But for most of us, the antelope is sort of coded as more exotic than the horse. Even if you live somewhere that has antelope, you think of a horse as a more everyday animal than an antelope, or at least I would presume you do. So the presence of the antelope body makes us think of the Hypsil as skittish, agile, and fast-moving, and then the centaurness makes us think of them as sort of characteristic wild men. But the fact that it's not the familiar centaur also adds this weird note of alienness and unfamiliarity. If you think about, like, a giant in Dungeons & Dragons, a lot of the time that giant has exactly the traits that you would expect from a giant, right? That's what you like from a folklore monster. So a hill giant is a big, dumb bully, or a cloud giant is a giant man who lives in the sky. And those are both very straight down the line giant archetypes, and those therefore mean something to us and we respond to them. By contrast, when you're dealing with like a Zorn, it doesn't mean anything to you. It's a gibberish monster. And that alienness is what's compelling about it, that when you're dealing with a Zorn and you're not quite sure how to respond to it, which is itself interesting. So the Hypsil seems to be kind of trying to strike a balance, incorporating familiar elements, but in unfamiliar ways that make you go, well, I kind of see what's going on here, but I'm going to need to investigate and find out more to really understand it. And I think that that's a very valuable thing. I might put some Hypsil in the next game I run. They never would have occurred to me to do it before, but actually, you know, given the very little that we see here about who the Hypsil are and what they do, I think they're kind of nice. So, all right, that's a pretty good way to close out the H chapter. In our next episode, we're going to be taking a look at the J chapter of Monster Manual 2, and that's going to involve a callback to one of our earlier special episodes about Jin. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.